Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle. Hello and welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor. As always, I'm joined by my two fabulous co-hosts, Peter Kalizos and Kate Bakos. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Dave. That was an enthusiastic intro.
I got up extra early this morning, so maybe that played a role. Good session of yoga.
Oh, nice one.
Pete, how are you doing in Adelaide, free Adelaide?
COVID-free, yeah. Almost COVID-free. Oh, very good. I have a little personal property market update. I did a Kate Bakos on the weekend. I went and bid for somebody at auction, but I didn't do a Kate and I missed out.
Oh, don't worry. There's plenty of missing out.
Interestingly, that afternoon I went to an off-market property for that person and we bought it. So missed out in the morning and got it in the afternoon. So
let me ask, was the second one better?
No, but the second one was almost $200,000 less in price. So that's okay.
Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Nice work, Pete.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it, Kate. I mean, I think I'm a relatively experienced property investor, but geez, my hands were clammy and my heart was beating at auction.
People always say to me, do you get nervous? And I don't, but I get a good hit of adrenaline and that helps.
Yeah, I haven't done it enough to not get nervous whenever I've bid for friends and family.
My heart is racing. I've seen you bid. Yeah. Oh, you put your hat on, you're hiding behind the tree. I was just thinking exterminate.
Incognito. Kate, how are you going? Obviously, things are a bit tougher in Melbourne.
Yeah, living the dream. Yeah, it's not great. I had a really interesting Saturday, though, and you would have loved it. I had clients who were bidding on a property. Well, I was bidding for the clients on a property in Geelong that we had seen before Geelong went into lockdown. So it's an unusual thing to think through because the regions were still able to move about when Melbourne went into hard lockdown. And we got our cases in the media in Shepparton, and then there was noise about them moving around the state. And at about 10 minutes to 11 on Saturday morning, the Premier announced we're going into a snap lockdown Victoria-wide, a hard lockdown. And, of course, we were wondering, you know, what time will this be? There was talk about it happening at midnight, and of course, he didn't give us that long. He didn't give us that long to prep and disappear. So 1 o'clock was the deadline, and I had my auction at 1:30. And the story for me is I was FaceTiming via an agent because we can't leave the city, and they'd kindly organise someone for me to have a chat to, and he would have his iPhone there, and I'd be able to see what's going on, etc. So, of course, my 1:30 auction, there's no more. They're bringing it forward. Everyone's bringing it forward. Every auction that was on for the 21st in Geelong has been brought forward. And he rang me in a bit of a flurry and said, right, we're on at 12:30. And I said, can't we just do Zoom? I'll host it. This will be great. No, we're doing 12:30. Okay. So is my guy going to ring me? Oh, yeah, sorry about that. He's got a different auction. And I was thinking, great, all right, so who will phone bid for me? And I'm just starting to get a little bit edgy. And he says, don't worry, my best friend's coming. Now, this guy, really nice guy, he was the auctioneer, but he's quite young. And I'm thinking, this is a lucky dip now. I'm getting some random who's not in the real estate industry, maybe rocking up, maybe calling me. Of course, he was there. He was great. Kept his word, rocks up. Hasn't got an iPhone, he's got an Android. So, of course, no FaceTime isn't an option. And I can't Zoom him because I'm Zooming my clients. So we've got Zoom running. I'm holding the handset. He uses the auctioneer's phone because, let's be honest, the auctioneer's not making calls while he's calling an auction. We actually pulled it off. So I had the phone facing the camera. I'm talking to him. My guys are watching it all unfold. It was the most magic thing I've ever done. It was great.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And you bought the property.
We bought the property.
Very good. Yeah. Very good.
I said to him, just go and stand next to the other bidder and put me on speakerphone.
Intimidating, even though you're 100 kilometres away, Kate.
Via the phone.
Whatever it takes. Whatever it takes.
Did you have your sunglasses on?
Like no. It was hilarious.
That's a great story.
Great story, Kate. That one. Better than mine. Very good. Very good.
My market update is just that the vacancy rates are holding steady at 1.7% from June to July. CBD vacancies have risen quite a bit in Sydney, which I guess is no surprise, but again, a reminder that the weakest part of the market feels the pinch the most during economic downturns. So Sydney's CBD vacancy rates jumped from 5.6 to 6.1%. Melbourne's has stayed pretty steady, is actually lower than Sydney's now, 5.7. Overall, the national vacancy rate's really low. Sydney and Melbourne are higher because of the CBD impact in particular. Brisbane's the only other capital city that's slightly over 1% at 1.3%. So that has caused rents to increase by 13.7% over the last 12 months. It's hard to understand what's driving this, given international borders are closed. So we're not getting new people to Australia. The question is, perhaps more landlords are increasingly using short-term accommodation websites such as Airbnb and Stays, where they have a greater say in, you know, who's staying there, the prices, the length of time. It's also possible that long-term leasing is becoming challenging for landlords due to some of the rental moratoriums that are still in place because of COVID. So certainly the rental market is still going strong. It'll be interesting to see how long that continues for with international borders closed. Do either of you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I do. We talked about this a little while ago in a significant market update special where we segmented the properties that have been low-hanging fruit for quite a while. So the properties that have been stuck on the market for whatever reason, maybe they're overpriced, maybe they're undesirable, maybe they're too small. I think it was you, Pete, that pointed it out. We saw an uptake in the long tenure listings. So buyers were finally saying, look, there's such limited stock. I'm so desperate. I'll buy the stuff that has been floating around for a long time, whether it's all of a sudden priced right because the market's moved or because they've decided compromising is what they'll do. So we've had a lot more of these undesirable properties picked up over this time. Not all of them, for sure. But if an owner-occupier buys a one-bedroom apartment in the sky, then all of a sudden we haven't got a vacancy. And we've seen a lot of that.
Absolutely. That certainly is one of the causes.
I have some breaking news. It looks like Western Australia and Perth have succeeded in seceding from the rest of the country, because on the 25th of August at 8:20, I'm looking at the CoreLogic data and nowhere does Perth appear. No daily information, monthly, quarterly, annually, even their daily index back series. Because you remember last week I said that Perth was the only capital city to have dropped. I mean, only for the daily index, which doesn't mean a lot at this stage. So I thought, well, I'd go and follow up and see what's happening this week. And it's nowhere. So
is there a chance that the trading hasn't opened yet, Pete? We're recording this in the morning.
But they don't even have historical data going back a year.
Oh, ouch. Okay.
Well, Mark McGowan, you've succeeded.
Emperor McGowan, you can't get into Perth and he's not letting anything out now either.
The Independent Republic of WA. Yeah.
So I can only guess what's happening to Perth prices, but hopefully we can give our Perth listeners an idea next week, and hopefully it's just some sort of anomaly in the CoreLogic website. But everyone else I can see here is green. Whether you look at a day, a quarter, a year, everything is still green. Everything is still moving up. And it's mainly due to a lack of supply, really.
I think one of the other factors in the rental increases was the high percentage of owner-occupiers that had been dominating the marketplace until a couple months ago. So obviously they were taking away investment stock as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we have had a flurry of investors, but let's be honest, if investors have really ramped things up in the last 2 or 3 months, that settled data won't have been filtering through yet.
Yeah, absolutely. For all you budding property planners out there, at Property Planning Australia, we are looking to hire a new property planner.
So if you live in Melbourne, have a passion for helping people make educated and superior property, mortgage and money management decisions, we would love to hear from you if you have at least 5 years of experience working as a fully qualified financial planner. If that sounds like you, please send us a copy of your CV to info@propertyplanning.com.au. You can also give us a call if you like on 1300 896 045.
All right, well, enough of the market updates. We'll move into today's episode, which is a really exciting one. It is Agent Behaviours That Buyers Don't Like, Part 2. So this is absolutely Kate's area of expertise.
Dave, you and I will go and get a coffee while Kate chats.
No, there's none of that. You've got heaps of expertise, both of you. And Pete, you've seen agent behaviours.
Yeah, well,
over
I can talk
years.
From the from the buyer side. Yep, certainly.
Yeah, and your dad was a real estate agent. You grew up in a house of real estate.
Well, I've got 10 questions listed here to ask, and usually that means we'll get through 5 of them.
Yep.
If we're lucky. But so the first question that I've got for you both, and we'll start with Kate, is tell us a bit about extending the negotiation or offer acceptance period. Why do agents do that?
Why do agents do that? Yeah. As much as buyers don't like it, the agent works for the vendor. So if they make a decision to extend that negotiating period, it might mean that it will likely mean that there's other players that they want to bring into the fold. And when you create competition, you obviously bolster prices. That is the job of the real estate agent. None of us like it. We never like it. We do everything we can to shorten it. We put timestamps on our offers. We put in an offer at an inopportune time for other buyers so that they haven't got a chance to, you know, get the lawyer onto things or get the building inspections done. But while we're trying to do that, limit competition, the agent is trying to expand competition. Simple as that. And if they're fearful that they only have the one buyer and they might lose them, they'll be less likely to do that extending type activity. And you'll see that in a buyer's market when it's tough on sellers and buyers are limited. The agents will be less likely to play those games because they just want to get that deal done. But in a seller's market, they know that competition equates to higher price points.
I've always considered if they're extending the period that they haven't had enough buyers and they're looking to enough potential purchases and they're looking to get more. And Kate, you're saying that they're also looking to increase the competition because rightly so, they are working for the vendor. They're trying to get the best price for the vendor.
And the agents will have a feel. They'll know if there's others in the mix who are happy to throw the hat in the ring or interested in the property and still deciding. It's like when you go to an auction and the auctioneer drags it out. He's giving people a chance to decide if they want to have a crack.
So, Kate, do you want to talk us through an example of what that might look like in real terms? So,
yes. Yeah. I'll use a real-life example.
Perfect. Even
I've got one at the moment. And, again, this is a Geelong property that my client saw before the lockdown and got really excited on Saturday morning. Yep, want to go for it. Okay, great. I've contacted the agent. We're keen to make an offer. Can I get the contract? When are you calling for offers? And she said, oh, look, the vendor isn't in a hurry yet. We're keeping it wide open. Okay. And then I got a message a few hours later saying, all offers to be in by Tuesday, strictly 2:00. Okay. So we prepped, done everything, got the offer in yesterday at 2:00. Still haven't heard anything. Texted her this morning, any update, how's it going? And she said the vendor is still waiting on some clarification around other offers, other terms. So, for example, someone might have said, oh, I'm subject to finance and not given a lot of insight into exactly what the context is. What's the LVR? How long do they need? Have they started the pre-approval process? So sometimes an agent will buy time. And for me, I've already put my offer in. I've been very clear. I know exactly where my client's situation sits. We're not subject to finance. It's now a waiting game. And what that means is, in all likelihood, the other offer that has the finance clause attached to it might be a higher offer than mine, but they're trying to determine whether it's actually a more desirable offer.
So in an example like that, there's a few questions I think listeners would be interested to understand. Firstly, there's no obligation on the agent to stick by that time other than just being a decent person.
Some agencies will have processes that are standardised and that's part of their position in the marketplace. They'll say we're very even-handed with all offers and all buyers. And a lot of them live and die by that. And it's really impressive when their rules are really consistent. But we have to remember with a private sale or a negotiation, there's nothing that's legislated around how the buyers are communicated with or what the time frame can be. The agent has full control of the process and they call the shots. The one thing that is a legal requirement is they need to submit all written offers to the vendor. But that's it.
So, Kate, talking about written offers, are they obligated to put a verbal offer down on paper? If I say I want to offer this much and it might be well below what the vendor wants, are they still obligated to present that?
An offer is not an offer unless it's on a contract
okay.
with a consideration. So if they're calling for $650,000 and you want to submit $500 on a 20-day settlement, you have to put it on a contract and attach a check or EFT them $1,000, whatever it might take. Mm-hmm. Your offer has to be on a contract.
Okay.
Some agents will call for expressions. They'll say, email me all of your terms and conditions or text me. I don't like that. I will text or email, but I'll also accompany it with a written offer on a contract that's got a real signature on it.
Excellent.
So then in that example, the person who's put in the offer, Kate, and then the agents called them up and said, look, we've actually extended it past 2 p.m. Thank you very much for providing your offer, though. But we're talking to some other people who've taken longer. Yeah. And then the buyer, the mythical buyer, or it was a real buyer in your situation, we're starting to feel nervous and worrying, oh, what happens if that other offer comes in, that other offer's better, I might be willing to go a bit higher, you know.
Right, if you've got room to move,
potentially.
You have to be very, very clear with the agent what the rules are.
Yeah.
So when you submit your offer, you've got to ask questions. And I always say, how are you going to conduct this process? Tell me your process and your rules.
Yeah.
And sometimes they say, what do you mean? Hmm. And I say to them, am I giving you my only offer and there's no negotiating? If I ask them that and they say, oh, look, no, I'm happy to come back to you, I say, okay, when I give you my offer, when can I expect to hear from you?
Yeah.
And that means I've got another crack. If they say, no, I'm not coming back to anyone, you get one go, best and highest, then that's it. You've put your best and your highest. And, yes, you'll be like a cat on a hot tin roof. But if you can't go higher or better, then it is what it is. You've put your best out there and you just have to be patient.
Okay, great example. And with my business, particularly, say, with the mortgage side, when we're dealing with lenders, and so often you're trying to clarify lender policy, and that can be the difference between a loan being approved or not. And you try to minimize the risk of lodging a loan where there's any gray. So I always talk about getting the lender to put in writing whatever they've told you. Will you ever ask the agents to put something like that in writing, or will you take their word for it and just document into notes in your CRM what they've said?
I've got no recourse if the agent changes their mind. So no, there's not a lot of point putting things in writing unless I've got a really anxious client and they are really needing to see what the agent's saying.
Yep.
But an agent can change their mind.
They don't have to stick to it like a lender has to stick to their lender policy.
Because a lender will make you an offer to borrow money and you've got a contractual arrangement with that lender. The agent doesn't owe a buyer that kind of commitment, unfortunately. And it is frustrating because a lot do change the rules, move the goalposts and play games. I had one guy that said, if you can give me X, I'll wrap this up. And, of course, I was pretty excited about that and X was a good price. So I wrote it up. I got the lawyer on a Saturday to look at everything. We submitted it. He was pretty hard to get a hold of. I had to make a lot of phone calls and texts. I was getting pretty shirty. And then I get an email late that night, oh, the vendor's decided that they'll, you know, have another week of opens. Well, thanks a lot, mate. You've got my best offer. Sometimes that happens. And all you can do is chalk it up to experience and remember that agent.
What's the saying about a long memory?
Yeah, absolutely.
So another thing that buyers will be nervous about there is that I'll say, look, it's, you know, here are my rules. Highest offer will be accepted. And then they'll say, well, look, actually, we're willing to take another offer over and above.
I get it all the time.
So what's the percentage? Because the average buyer, our listeners will be thinking, well, I don't want that to happen to me, but it can happen and they can break the rules or break their word. So is it 1 in 10? Is it 1 in 3? How often would you say they would actually go back on their word in a situation like that?
About 70%.
Really? Okay. Very, yep. Okay. Yeah.
Very common. Very common. And I'm not advising that people leave a little bit of room in the tank.
Right.
Yep. Because for the 30% that don't come back to you, you'll be remorseful that you didn't go that extra five. But be prepared for that phone call. And sometimes it's not about more money. Sometimes it's about being prepared to ease one of your requirements or one of your clauses. Mm. And I'll give you an example. I had a client who said they wanted a 14-day finance clause. I already knew that they were almost there with their pre-approval. They'd had to go in with a new set of pay slips and all the rest of it to reinstate an already existing pre-approval. And based on what their broker had told us, we knew that we were probably days away. And so when I got that phone call and the agent said, can you do any better? I said, be very specific. Do you need more money? Do you want a different settlement time? They said, oh, look, we've got an offer that's really similar to yours, but it's got better conditions. And it was really interesting because we were able to do a short-range building and pest inspection, whereas they had a long one. And they had a shorter finance clause and we had a long one. And so I said to the client, we've got a 3-day cooling off period here. If we can shorten your finance clause, we've got the option to ask for an extension, which will really annoy the vendor because if they accept our offer and then 3 days later we're saying, oh, can we buy another 2 days, that will agitate them, but they risk losing the buyer altogether because the other buyer. Exactly.
So that's doing a bit of the agent's tricks back onto them.
Yep. A little bit. Yeah. But as it turns out, we got the finance pre-approval through on day 3, so we didn't need to reinstate that. But we were able to pip the other offer and just sneak it in without having to budge on price. So when they come back to you, the moral of the story is find out what it is you could move on. Now, if you can throw an extra $1,000 on the pile and the agent's giving you the impression that that could get it across the line, then that's a really valuable tip.
Some great tips there. Put in your best offer when they do ask for best and highest, but don't be surprised if they come back and either delay the time frame or even ask if you're willing to go higher again. But you don't want to regret not having gone high enough in the instances where that doesn't happen and it could have cost you purchasing the property.
I think it's really important to point out that agencies that do this closed tender thing, and a lot do, especially in the regions, some of them it's just in their script to ring every buyer back and say, have I got your best and highest?
Yeah.
It's just in the script. Mm. So it doesn't mean that you're necessarily $1,000 away from someone else. It's exactly the same as when you order your burger and they say, would you like fries with that? It's just in the script.
Yeah, awesome. Great tips for our listeners. Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au. In terms of not offering private inspections when a real estate agent does that, talk us through why.
Okay. Private inspection is different to an open for inspection. And sometimes a vendor will have a really particular need for not having random people through their house. And it might be that they've got an infant or they're not well or that there's a particular reason why they would really prefer that the agent adhered to the open for inspections. Other times the agent's lazy. Other times the agent's really busy. And when the agent has a lot of properties on their books and they're facilitating 3 sets of opens a week, it's really hard for them to be navigating extra private inspections. So that's something to remember. Now, the other thing is if the agent feels that the buyer is a waste of their time, so they're just looking for the sake of looking and not seriously either prepared to sign a contract or in a position to buy, or if they believe that the buyer's budget's nowhere near where it needs to be, they'll just say come through the open. And lastly, if the property's flying, like it's really doing well, it's got lots of buyers on it and the agent's prepared to just bank that, they'll preserve their own time and say that only come through the opens. And it will always be in the form of the vendors not allowing opens, unfortunately. Agents won't usually say, I'm not bothering with you. And the last one, which is something that happens a lot, is if the property is tenanted, you have to anticipate that getting through on a private will be really hard. And in our state, it now costs the agency to facilitate, well, it gets passed on to the vendor, but every inspection, the tenant is now rebated.
Sorry, Kate, what's that? A
rental property, every open for inspection or private inspection, the tenant is entitled to a rebate.
You pay them some money?
You have to. Yeah, it's legislated.
My goodness me.
I've never heard that before.
I know certainly in South Australia we don't do that. I'm pretty sure in all the other states and territories they don't do that.
Yeah, it's a relatively new introduction to our legislation here. Yeah, we had an enormous array of changes to our tenancy laws, and that was one of them. So agents and vendors are reluctant to chalk up lots of inspections if they have to put their hand in their pocket.
And do you know how much notice they have to give the tenant if they want to come through? Is it 7 days, 14 days?
Yeah, seven is the minimum, yeah. But a good cruisy tenant will say no problem. Yeah. So, you know, it's not legislated that it has to be strictly 7 days notice. If the tenant's happy, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Pete, over the years, what from your experience, what has been an example or examples of some agent behaviour that has frustrated you?
Some of the stuff that Kate's already talked about, like they say, give us your highest and best offer, and then they call you back and say, do you have any more? I really hate that. I really hate it when agents don't call me back. And that's just common decency in business, isn't it? All right, I understand you may not be able to get back to me that day, but what about the next day? And if they don't get back to you, I mean, I'd love to hear Kate's opinions, probably because they're flat out with other phone calls, so they don't need to get back to you, especially in this market, you know. Properties are selling within days, not weeks. So, you know, I understand it. Even outside of this market, you know, one of the common complaints of my students or property investors is that agents they just don't get back to them. And I think from a professional point of view, that's something that agents can look at because it's just common business procedure. Yeah.
They're getting smashed with inquiry
at the
when
moment.
The market's
I can imagine.
Hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not making excuses. I struggle sometimes with my calls. It can really bank up, and you listen to your voicemail message bank, and you've got seven calls. And while you're listening to those seven calls, another three come in. That can happen. And if you really need to catch an agent, shoot them an email and a text.
It's really an example of the provision of providing great service. It's not easy. Yeah. You know, there's high turnovers in most professions, and there certainly is in real estate, in the real estate business. But one of the fundamentals of providing great service is getting back to people in a timely manner. And every business obviously strives for everyone in their team to do that. And those that prosper, both individuals and businesses, are the ones that do it consistently, do it all the time.
You would hope that they're doing the right thing, because that prospective purchaser one day could be a prospective vendor. And if you don't do the right thing, if they don't have a great experience first time around, they're not going to pick you when it comes time to sell their home.
No.
So, yeah, look, they're just a few of the things that I don't like in regards to agents' behaviour. But luckily we have an expert here on our podcast, and I'm sure she's got many more tips and ideas for us.
So
I love it.
The next one on the list is, which we've talked about, and you know, it's something we certainly recommend our clients to do. Sometimes people can get frustrated when the agent insists on a signed contract and a deposit payment.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that they can just put forward a verbal.
Mm.
And legally, it doesn't mean anything. And because agent practices vary from agency to agency in relation to documentation of an offer, it can be a bit of a shock for someone if they've had a few experiences where a verbal or an emailed offer has been acceptable to the agent, and all of a sudden this agent is saying, I want you to sign a contract and put money into the trust account. And some people get really nervy about that because they're parting with, whether it's $1,000 or $5,000, it's a significant amount of money to put into an account when you haven't got a rapport with this agent, you don't know how your offer is going to be treated, and you hear the occasional bad practice horror story about deposits being lost. But when a deposit is paid into an agency trust account, the trust account is sacred. The agents can't take that money and put it somewhere else. It's all accounted for. So if you're doing that, if you're making a transfer, you need to ask for a receipt. If you're handing over a check, you ask for a receipt. But that is technically how it should be done. So if an agent requires that, it doesn't mean you've bought the property, but it means they're taking your offer seriously.
Will you ever put in an offer without signing a contract and providing a check or a small deposit?
For sure, if I have to and if that's how they're calling for it. But you need to be aware that it's not a real offer.
Yeah.
So if you've submitted a signed offer, it has to be legally shown to the vendor. And bear in mind that there will be some vendors who have been burnt by verbal offers, and they will be hypersensitive to someone just throwing out an offer and then going quiet. And it does happen. I remember as an agent, it happened to me and I learnt the hard way. I documented everything because if someone gives you a decent offer verbally, you present it to the vendor gets excited, then you call the buyer back and they're not taking the call. You've made a real mess of things. Mm. So there will be agents and vendors that are very sensitive to making sure the offer's genuine. When it's on a contract and there's money in the bank, that's genuine.
I understand that real estate rules are state-based, so things might be a bit different in South Australia than they are in Victoria and other states. But for us here, we have to wait for the agent to give us a copy of the contract to fill it in. Like I had an example a few weeks ago. There was a development site and I said, I'd like to make it subject to planning approval. They said, oh, the vendor won't be interested. I said, well, I'm happy to pay you more than the asking price, but I want subject to development approval. The least you can do is put it in writing. And if the vendor says no, then that's okay. But he wouldn't even give me a contract so that I could put it in writing. What would they do in Victoria? What should they do in Victoria?
In any state, they should let you put all of your terms and conditions on there. It's a contract. Hmm. And you're not holding a gun at a vendor's head saying you have to accept that. No. You're saying, here is my offer with my terms and conditions, and it's up to the vendor to make that decision.
Good. I'll point that out next time. I just want to put it in. You have to put it in writing, mate. If he doesn't like it, it's a different story.
They have the right to say no. Yeah, absolutely. They have the right to say no.
Maybe he's worried the buyer would like it.
I mean, I understand why they don't want subject to planning approval, because if you say, you know, subject to planning approval is in 6 to 8 weeks, then there's uncertainty for 6 to 8 weeks. I understand that. And in this market, you probably don't need that because you're going to get the price that you want or even higher. But at least put it in writing so that they can say no. Anyway.
The agent didn't want that delay.
No. What's
too long to wait for the commission.
That's right.
So many buyers and certainly property professionals like ourselves do get frustrated with the non-disclosure of sale prices, because obviously that means the quality of the data that we're assessing is not to the standard. But there's no legislation or requirement for agents to disclose sale prices. What are some of the reasons that agents don't disclose?
Will undisclose.
Yeah, sale prices.
Sometimes the vendors don't want their friends and family knowing what the house sold for. Sometimes the buyers don't want their friends and family knowing what they paid.
Yeah.
Sometimes the agent is embarrassed by the price because it's low and it's not a great reflection on their ability to get a strong result.
Yeah.
And other times it's too high compared to what they quoted the property and they're a bit awkward about that.
Mm.
So there's all kinds of reasons why prices are undisclosed. They're probably the four main ones. I find it very frustrating, particularly when I've paid for a portal that is meant to give me data that I can use and it's undisclosed in the Valuer General's data pool. I get very frustrated by that because our analysis relies on data integrity. When there's gaps, it's really hard.
Yeah, it's really frustrating when there's gaps. It's certainly the bane of our existence when it comes to analysing property. Another example of when they're not disclosed is particularly in medium to high density apartment blocks. And, you know, one low sale can set a precedent for the whole building. And often, you know, one agent or a couple agencies are handling most of the sales in an apartment block. So they are very reticent to share sale prices where they might have undercut the market overall within a block. So that's certainly another common example and why it's often very difficult to find sale values, certainly for first-time sales, so new sales and off the plans, and often even for secondary onward sales.
And a lot of stuff can be hidden within that sale price. You know, this apartment sold fully furnished. This one did not. This apartment sold with a $10,000 cashback offer.
Yeah.
You need to
only if you're privy to the contract particulars, you can say that there was maybe a $50,000 cashback. I've seen a $100,000 cashback.
I know back in the last boom that we had in Adelaide, 2001, 2 and 3, they were selling some apartments down at Port Adelaide. Adelaide people might remember Newport Keys, and they were selling brand new BMWs and boats. That was included in the sale price of the apartment, just to lift that sale price up. But of course, when you go and sell it, you know, nobody's giving you a BMW or a boat to go with it.
Yeah.
And so then interesting that means, tricks.
Exactly. There's a recording, let's say, if the data gets trapped, of a sale price of, say, $400,000, and they want that to be reasonably consistent across the whole development, but there's $50,000 Mercedes being given to some people and not everybody. Some people are getting boats. Some people are getting $10,000 back, so it's really $390,000.
Some people are getting a two-year rental guarantee.
And some people are getting nothing and getting duped to pay the full amount. So, these are the sort of some of the tricks that occur with new off-the-plan sales. All right. Well, we're coming towards the end of this episode. We've touched on agents not calling back. What about maybe a last one, Kate? Or is there anything that there's still a few questions, as always, that we didn't get to? Is there any last example of buyers disliking agent behavior that you would like to share?
There are lots of agent behaviors that agitate buyers. And I think the important thing is to always bear in mind that the agent works for the vendor. If the agent behaviour is letting you down because they're not getting back to you or they're telling you misleading information or whatever, that's a fair gripe and it does happen. There are some things that agents do that are unforgivable, and then there are other things that, you know, require a buyer to step back and say, this agent is not working for me. And I think the main thing that I'd point out is be the buyer that gives an agent confidence that they're putting their time and energy into a buyer that could be the right buyer, whether it be for this property or for another property. You've got to give them confidence that you're prepped and ready, you know what you're doing, you're prepared to make a purchase decision. But to just pick out one of my pet hates, and I think this is really important for anyone who's contemplating an investment, when you rely on an agent to quote the rent, and they give you a figure that sounds really compelling, they can overquote the rent, especially when it's a verbal overquote. Mm. And if you're reliant on that, you're running all of your numbers for your cash flows on that, you'll get a nasty surprise when you settle. And the property manager says, nah, it was never going to get that. Mm. So an important tip is, firstly, don't put the agent on the spot to tell you that. And don't take it all for granted. And if it does sound believable, get a second opinion. But you are much better off talking to an independent local property manager. Just send them the link.
Yeah.
They'll be able to give you a far better idea. For all of the agents that genuinely want to help with rental appraising, I find that it's not a huge percentage that are totally on the money when it comes to picking the right rental.
Great tip to finish on, Kate. They've certainly got a vested interest to overstate the likely rental return to help push up the estimated value for the potential buyer. So, fantastic tip. All right. Well, it's been another great episode. I think it really provides some wonderful insights for our listeners on one of the most nerve-wracking components of buying property, which is the negotiation. So I look forward to both of your gold nuggets. If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
We might start with you today, Pete.
So my gold nugget stems from what Kate said. There was a classic comment. An offer's not an offer unless it's in writing. So I would strongly encourage our listeners to contact their local branch of the Real Estate Institute, maybe also their local branch of Consumer and Business Affairs, or whatever the term is in your particular state and territory, and find out what the rules are about offers in writing. Because here in South Australia, sometimes it's very hard for a prospective purchaser to get a copy of that contract so they can put their offer in writing. And look, if your offer is not an offer unless it's in writing, doesn't matter what you say, it means nothing. Get that offer in writing.
Great tip, Pete. Actually, just quickly, why is it sometimes hard for the potential buyer to get a copy of the contract in Adelaide or South Australia?
They just don't want to present that offer for whatever reason. You know, I don't know. Yeah. But I'm sure this is the case in other states, but we just don't have one template. Like, we have the Real Estate Institute has their contract. The Law Society has their contract. The Australian Institute of Conveyances has theirs. It's not like we can go somewhere and get a copy of a contract and submit. Yep. We have to wait for them to pass over the paperwork.
In Victoria, and in a lot of states, there are a few reasons why it might be hard to get your hands on the contract. First one is it's still being produced. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's not ready yet, some states can market a property without having a contract ready. And you're going to the regions, sometimes they will market the property without having even started prepping the contract, with the idea that when they get an appropriate verbal offer, they'll then start on the contract process so that they're saving the vendor a few hundred dollars.
That is frustrating.
Yeah. But often it might be that they don't want offers yet. So in the case of an auction property, they might hold back contracts, or they'll have an unsigned vendor statement, which means you can do what you want, but it's not a real contract without the vendor's signature on it.
Yeah.
Or it might be a draft form. So there will be reasons, and it really does rely on communication with the agent. If you're doing something that they really don't want you to do, you've got to find some middle ground and work out with them what the appropriate way to do this is. Because if you go head to head with an agent when they are the conduit between you and the vendor, you might find that you don't get what you want and you burn an agent and you're on their radar for a long time after that.
It's a great tip, Kate. Work with the agent, not against the agent.
As much as you can. Yeah. Yes, obviously they're working for the vendor, but if you're the buyer that gives them confidence and communicates clearly and is as respectful as you need to be to get the job done, that will hold you in high favour compared to anyone who's giving them a hard time. And my gold nugget is work out what they're going to do with your offer, how they wish to field offers, and when they plan to have their vendor make a decision on offer acceptance before you put pen to paper. You've got to know all of that background before you give them your offer and show your cards, because they might be happy to present it as soon as you've written it and get it signed off for you, but they might be holding out with a closeout date that's a week away. So ask some questions before you put pen to paper.
Well, great way to finish another superb episode, particularly providing some great insights on how to manage the behaviours that buyers don't like, and particularly most of them were centred around the negotiation process, which I'm sure our listeners will have got a lot out of. Thanks, guys. Look forward to seeing you both next week. Hopefully Melbourne case numbers and Sydney case numbers start.
Everyone case numbers.
Yeah, well, anyone else who has case, ACT, where else is there?
And hopefully Perth has rejoined the rest of the country.
Yeah.
We see them back on the CoreLogic card.
So good to see you guys.
Thank you. See you later. See you next week.
See you guys.
Bye. Bye.
If you've enjoyed today's episode and would like to learn more about negotiating a property purchase, take a listen to episode number 20, Bidding Tactics 101. Episode 29, Congenial Negotiation Tactics and How to Apply Them in the Right Situation. Episode 77, Understanding the Real Estate Agent Behaviours That Buyers Don't Like, Part 1. Episode 85, Off the Market Properties, Everything You Need to Know. And finally, episode 94, Purchasing Property in Australia, The Winner's Curse and How to Avoid It.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company, Property Planning Australia, provides the only independent, pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.